Very good. We got another Build Your Legacy webinar series with Andy McMullen, my partner at Legacy, and we got a special guest for you today, Lance Peterson. We're going to chop it up about all kinds of stuff, teaching mortals how to create funds, series LLCs, business advice before starting a fund. I definitely want to hit that particular topic. Welcome, everybody. Really excited for this. We're going to be talking about all kinds of capital raising strategies and creating systems for all of the aspiring fund managers and for existing fund managers. So with that, welcome everybody. Really excited here. Okay, cool. So let's dive right in. Lance, you were on a podcast with me about 2 years ago. Let's start with this, man. What have you been up to since then? What are you doing in the fund world?
Yeah, so still doing quite a bit of the same stuff that I was the first time we did the show. Consulting with guys who are looking to start funds, spend a lot of time doing that, all sorts of strategies, just walking them through the, you know, Sherpa, basically, you know, help them through the process and getting all the docs together. And then I also, you know, am a GP on a few deals of different strategies. So that's kind of my system, right? Is just, you know, help others sort of get going. And then to the degree there's a good fit and they're kind of at a certain inflection point where they need someone like myself to handle, you know, investment management, you know, capital management, capital raising, stuff like that, I can kind of slide in with the sponsors who got a proven strategy and take on an ownership stake as a general partner with them.
Very cool. Well, so walk us through this timeline of how you started doing funds and what your experience has been in that space and how you got involved with helping people set up funds in the first place.
Yeah, sure. Yes. I mean, my first foray into a pooled investment fund was in 2008. So I joined a buddy of mine who was a hard money lender on small balance commercial real estate loans up in the Pacific Northwest, kind of joined his team. They had an existing open-ended fund, you know, where they'd raise money from high net worths and then, you know, make loans out of the fund. So cut my teeth on that. You know, it was a pretty complex structure. We had a debt facility, like a $50 million, you know, debt facility. And so that's really where I kind of learned all the ins and outs of, you know, how can you structure it, you know, all the securities laws and things like that. At the time, there wasn't the Jobs Act, right? So, you know, you didn't have the ability to publicly advertise and solicit. And then in 2010, we started getting a lot of people reaching out to us saying, hey, you guys run a fund. You know, we're thinking about buying a bunch of single family homes, or we're thinking about making loans to guys that do this, and any advice. And that really ended up becoming really what was the genesis of the advisory practice. So we would, at that time, similar to what I do today, you know, they'd say, hey, I don't have a fund, I want a fund. We'd talk it through, it seemed to make sense. At the time, they were paying us like $60,000 to do that back in the day. So that's really how I got started in that side of it. We kind of parlayed that into allocating capital out of an open-ended fund that we had created, kind of a kitchen sink fund that would allow us with a broad mandate to invest in other funds, syndications, joint ventures, you know, all real estate related. So that was sort of the driving force for a lot of guys, is they'd hire us to consult on the formation of their own investment fund. And then we would potentially allocate money into theirs.
You know, what's interesting, Ruben, is you came in probably about the same time I did, in a similar scenario where you're kind of doing multiple things. So I was at a boutique real estate firm where you're learning about asset management, your underwriting, property management, and all that's on their dollar too, right? So your mistakes aren't as public as they would be today on your own deals. But then somehow I kind of came back to what I started off doing, and now I'm kind of doing it. We're doing it together on our own stuff, which is, you know, mostly built to rent development. But for you, I remember in that 2012 range, the market really hadn't come back yet. 2013, it started to kind of come back where you could be buying things. What were you guys doing throughout that process? Because I imagine you learned a lot about, eventually we'll get through Ruben's questions, but eventually I'd like to see kind of what similarities you see to now. Mm-hmm. And how, you know, we've got to kind of navigate some of these difficult times that we were seeing. 2011, we didn't know if it was coming back. 2012, we didn't know if it was coming back. We're kind of messing around buying things. I know you're a big proponent of kind of not timing the market, but constantly being thinking about not acting too quickly. So I know there's a few things there, but I'd like to hear kind of what you remember about that time of 2012.
Yeah, no, great point. I mean, and the reason we sort of backed away from private lending at the time, and mainly because our specialty was more in like the owner-occ, small balance commercial stuff, because of the volatility in the market in terms of valuations, you know, we just weren't as comfortable and our upside was capped. right? I mean, we might make the loan at 12%, you know, but with the waterfall at the fund level, I mean, we might end up, your upside's capped. I mean, you can only make so much money, right? But yet you're underwriting the deals like they're equity deals. So for us, that was sort of the aha moment was, hey, listen, the market's been completely disrupted. The opportunities are going to be in different places, right? And we didn't want to be sort of pigeonholed into any given strategy, right? And so, you know, at the time, that's when we started looking into, you know, multifamily and, you know, just things that seemed to make sense because people were able to get in at good basis. And so that was really what we did at that time was like, hey, just, you got to look at where the opportunity is at the moment and be, you know, allocating capital to those particular strategies. And I think that's really what we did because we really were, it was a private equity real estate investment firm. I mean, that's what we were, and that's what that firm is today. But yeah, when you look at it now, it's interesting because multifamily is overheated and it's hard, you know, a lot of competition. I mean, everyone got in there. I mean, back in 2014, 2015, people didn't even know really what a syndication was. They didn't, you know what I mean? Like people talk about multifamily. I mean, you had to teach them everything, like, you know, shelter is a good thing. And, you know, like they didn't know anything about it. And of course we all know what happened there. It just boomed. And, you know, I think that's probably the asset class that people are the most comfortable with at this point. But yeah, we've always been opportunistic, really looking at anything that had good fundamentals and made sense and try to get into it before others do, you know, like self-storage conversions, you know, big box conversions, things like that. Like I feel like that was sort of our thesis, was be the early entrant into some of these things and then get out when everyone else discovers it.
So Lance, there's a lot of people who are interested in launching a fund, but they don't know how to do it, what kind of information to get, where to find information, who to use as an attorney, what they should be paying for a fund. They have a lot of questions, so there's not really a go-to source to find this information. But I've seen that there's a few people that refer to themselves, like you do, as fund architecture consultants that kind of give people insight onto whether or not they should launch a fund, whether or not it's realistic or makes sense for them to find a, or to launch a fund. Because a lot of times people will be like, I'll just go and talk to a lawyer, set up a fund, and then magically the money will be there and I can take that money and put it into whatever it is that I want to invest in. Mm-hmm. What kind of advice are they missing? What typically are they screwing up on as they launch their fund by just talking to a lawyer without talking to a business professional first?
Yeah, great question. You know, I think it's really important to understand that at the end of the day, there's something that's driving one's need to want to start a fund. And you have to really kind of pan out and think of it like it's a business, right? And that means that you need to have a strategy. You know, you need to know, like, there's got to be something like there. And then appreciating the fact that, you know, securities attorneys, their job isn't to come up with your business plan. Their job is to make sure that whatever your business plan is documented in legal documentation and that it's protecting you, right? To ensure that, you know, all the clauses are there. And in large part, the protections come from ensuring that you're disclosing the material risks of the investment opportunity and the conflicts of interest, et cetera, right? So that if something did go sideways, you're protected. So I think that's the big mistake is just thinking that you can go to the attorney and just say, give me a fund, right? Like, it's just not that simple. With my clients, I mean, I usually always land in a place. I mean, when you look at the documents, for all intents and purposes, they look pretty similar. I think the big process is just things I talked about. It's like, well, what is your strategy? How do you add value? You know, how do you do what you do? And that really then drives the structure. So that's always been sort of our maxim, right? Is that the asset type should drive the structure of the fund, right? It's just that it's not every fund should be open-ended. And by that meaning, like giving investors a redemption right to get out of the fund, not every fund should be closed-ended. All those considerations, you have to look at the underlying strategy and what you're trying to accomplish and trying to create, you know, the most aligned structure for the benefit of the investors, you know, something that's marketable, right? Because at the end of the day, it's a net new product that it's an investment product that you're launching into the market. It's just like coming up with a new brand of cereal or potato chips or anything else, right? Like, it's got to be something that people actually want to buy. And so I think that's where a lot of the mistakes are made, is just that people sort of skip all those steps and aren't contemplating, well, what is it that I'm doing? And it is difficult, right? Like, if you've never done it before, you don't know what you don't know. To think that someone can jump on a call with me and 30 minutes later know everything they need to know to do it is sort of misguided, right? Like, it's not that simple. And a lot of times too, what I found is just, I mean, really the process, what I'm really doing is I'm preparing them not only to, you know, help them create the right product, you know, that is marketable, but one that they can actually sell, right? Because that's what we saw early on is that guys show up and say, hey, I got this fund. Will you guys want to invest in it? And we'd be like, tell me about it. What's the structure? How's it work? You know, whatever. And they're like, well, I think it's kind of like this. And then you look at the documents and it's something different. Right. Or then you ask a harder question like, well, you know, do you have a key man provision or do you, you know, or whatever it is. Right. And they're like, I don't know what that means. Right. Cause and you guys have, if you've dealt with any investors at all, you know that they end up, some of them, some small percentage read the documents and they'll come back and say, what the hell is this? Like, what does this mean? And you don't want to be caught flat footed because then you look like you don't know what you're talking about. You need a strategy. You need something that adds value and it's got to be crystal clear and it should be as narrow as possible to attain success. I mean, if you're saying, I'm going to do this. I mean, maybe you could do it, right? But that's hard to sell, right? How can you convince people that you're good at like 12 different things?
Yeah, that's what the thing I wanted to ask about is a lot of people that are starting funds are single individuals who maybe have a network of people and they're saying, hey, look, I've got all these people that trust me, but they're typically also a very entrepreneurial type. They don't necessarily have the accounting lockdown. They don't have the legal part lockdown. They don't have kind of the PR and managing people around them lockdown. And so when you're consulting somebody, or actually I should ask a different way, when you're investing with somebody, for me personally, I wouldn't invest with somebody unless I'm pretty familiar that they've got a team. As an individual can't be good at 12 things. And if they were, I would be very, very, if they say that they were, I'd be very, very skeptical.
Yeah.
So what teammates should they have in that structure that you're actually, you know, referring to?
Yeah, great question too. I mean, like once again, it just goes back to like investing in a startup company or something like that, right? Like they always say it's like you look at the team because the team's got to execute the strategy. So first you got to have a strategy, then you got to have the team. And certain strategies don't necessarily require like an allocator strategy. You know, it's easier to be someone who raises money for, you know, goes and finds and, you know, builds relationships with sponsors that already have a proven strategy and figures out how to negotiate enhanced economics to get into a given deal, given how much they invest. Like it wouldn't require the same team as someone who's trying to execute a deep value add multifamily strategy, right? With that said, I mean, I think the main three roles that need to be filled by somebody are who's finding the deals, like who's executing the asset acquisition strategy, and then who's handling the asset management function. So post-investment, who's going to make sure that the investments are performing and the business plan is being executed as planned. And then the third component, which is that's sort of where my niche at this point, right, is that third component is who's the one who's handling the capital management function, which is, you know, investor relations, capital raising, you know, some of the financing stuff or whatever, someone who's just more about ensuring that reporting is going out timely and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But those are really the three main pillars that someone's name has to be in one of those boxes. Generally speaking, you know, I think you can have the same name in probably the asset acquisition and asset management to some, you know, for some period of time. And I think this is where a lot of people have realized that maybe I should start a fund is because I think we've all realized whether articulating it or not, it's the third box that is where a lot of people struggle because it's hard to go out and chase deals because you're, you know, I call them dirt kickers. I mean, you're out in the field, you're, you know, you're running around, you're negotiating with sellers and brokers and, you know, that's a whole business unto itself. So how do you do that while you simultaneously are out there trying to talk with the other side, which is, you know, high net worth individuals, doctors, dentists, et cetera, you know, that's really tough to pull off. And depending on the strategy, once again, the asset management component could be in large part outsourced through, you know, third-party property managers and things like that, right? But yeah, once again, it goes back to what is your strategy? What is it you're trying to accomplish? And then being able to defend how deep your team is or isn't, right? Like it all goes into it.
Is there anything that you've seen over the years, Lance, that if somebody did a fund with you would make the fund more profitable for the operator, sponsor, general partner versus like what are the lawyers missing in the docs that's making them lose a few extra dollars along the way? Anything like that that you put into the docs that helps make it more profitable, give it more sense to work with you versus just going direct to a lawyer?
I guess it all comes down to just, once again, the ability to defend whatever's put into the document. So, you know, one of the principles I use to guide me is put money where the work is. So it's just being cognizant of the fact that all these things you need to do to run a fund, acquire assets, manage assets, et cetera, is just making sure that whatever fees that you do put behind those are appropriate for the amount of work. Like, you know, I had a lot of clients who were acquiring, you know, distressed debt, notes, discounted notes and things like that. Like, it's a super labor intensive strategy. And then they didn't have, you know, well, we don't need an acquisition fee or, you know, everyone else is only charging a 1% fund management fee. So I think that, you know, that's what we should do. So those are mistakes people make where I'm like, listen, you can, if you can defend it, if you put the money where the work is, then you can defend a higher fee. I mean, you have to defend something. Don't just throw random fees out there or not put any fees out there because you think that it'll make it less marketable, right? Like, it's just making sure you can defend whatever you come up with. So I think some people leave money on the table there because they might do things like, well, I want to be able to tout that I don't have a fund management fee, right? And then I'm like, well, what if shit hits the fan? What are you going to do then? Now you're being paid. You're not going to work for free. That's actually a bigger risk to the investors than you think, right? Like, I'd rather defend the fund management fee and say, listen, I don't have a crystal ball. I think, you know, we feel confident we know what we're doing, but hey, if something happens in the economy, a black swan event or whatever, don't you want to know that there's someone there being paid to make sure that this thing continues to operate? So things like that. Now there's other, you know, how you structure the waterfall obviously is another area that needs to be looked at. And this requires math and, you know, you've got to actually understand how it is. So in certain situations, because like a lot of like the straight venture capital, private equity deals, there's always a catch up, right? So there might be some hurdle, like, you know, an 8% preferred return to the investors, and then it's an 80-20 split thereafter, but they have a catch up clause, right? So it's like, well, yeah, the 8 pref's there, but we get caught up to where it's whatever you get, we're going to end up having where we've got a pro rata share 80-20 on the pref as well. So when at the end of the day, you look at the fund after it's being liquidated, it actually is a true 80-20 split. Whereas in most real estate deals, they're in funds, there generally aren't catch-ups. And I mean, I don't necessarily know, I mean, I have an idea why they don't, but when you look at that, even in that situation, if it's an 8 pref 80-20 split, and you looked at the cash flow analysis after all assets are liquidated, it won't actually be 80-20. It'll be something more like the investors getting 83-17, sorry, right? And those are the things, like, I've got models that, I mean, I built all these models. So it's like, well, let's not just talk about it, because I know that's kind of how people are. They just, well, I think I need to, you know, they come to me and say, I want to do this, right? And this is kind of how the attorney dysfunction goes, because the attorney reads that as, well, you just told me what you want, so I'll just put in there what you said. Whereas I look at it and go, I know, but is that the right thing to do? Right? Like, have you actually like run numbers to see if that makes sense? Because maybe you are leaving money on the table. For me, like, that's where I, at times, once again, given the strategy, I mean, I'm always thinking LPs, I want to help LPs, you know, reduce their downside risk, right? Because LPs have no control. So that's their biggest concern, whether it's spoken or not spoken. It's that I want to do things. That's why preferred returns exist, right? Because it's saying, let me put a hurdle in there before I get a bite at the apple. I'm protecting your downside risk, right? So now I'm incentivized to, you know, try to meet and exceed plan, right, before I'm going to be compensated, things like that. And if there's, you know, protect their downside risk. So sometimes that might mean you use a 10 pref instead. But in exchange for me giving you a 10 pref, I probably have a, you know, it's a two-tiered structure where I'll give you a 10 pref and we'll do an 80-20 split up to a 15 IRR. And then we go 60-40, you know, like, it's going to bend in my favor if I can get you to that 15. But once again, like, you can't just take that in a vacuum. That's not the right answer in every situation. You really have to understand at the asset level, how do these deals work? In some situations, it makes sense, and others, it doesn't.
Yeah, that's so good. I tell people all the time, they come to me with a deal and they're like, oh, look, we're not taking any fee until we got to, you know, 18 months down the project or whatever it is. And I'm just like, you make me pretty nervous that if you're not taking any kind of fee. I am curious. So part of what you are doing in your past life was verifying a lot of the sponsors and operators that are out there. And I know there's probably a lot of people that came into the game 2017, 2018, a lot of things that you see that people are probably not doing as well as they were doing before the Jobs Act. What are some of those things? Maybe it's two or three don'ts. I know you're big on reporting. But what are some of those kind of things that are maybe are simple, but they're not easy for operators that are newer to the game that you usually can, you know, suss out right away? It's probably not qualified for them to be, you know,
yeah,
whether it was bear invested before or consulting now or investing. Sure. What are some of these things?
Yeah, I mean, I think the big thing, right, and it's super important, is just to never minimize the importance of good record keeping just in general. That's always been my big beef. It's like, you really don't have any good excuse. I don't care how new you are or you're not. If you closed on a deal, you signed legal, you know, you signed something, paperwork was involved. We all know that, right? There was a closing statement, right? Those things exist. Put it in a folder, because I think a lot of people, it's just where they're misrepresenting their track records and saying they did things they didn't do. I just think the easy step for that is just like, just save everything, right? You do deals, you save stuff. So someone asks for it, you have it. Because to me, that's the rookie move, is, you know, as an investor, I don't care. It's not a valid excuse if I say, well, can you share that information with me? And then it takes you 6 weeks to give me the information. It's like that tells me all I need to know about you. Right. And so, and then the same thing with just short shrifting, sort of just the asset level bookkeeping or things like that. Like, you want to find qualified people to handle the books, right? To protect yourself, one, from embezzlement and, you know, all sorts of things. But it's like, you have to lock that down. It doesn't need to be you, but find somebody that is doing it, so that when people ask you for information, you have that information, because otherwise you just look like an amateur.
I'm curious about this, man. Can you tell us a little bit about when it makes sense for somebody, a syndicator, to actually go ahead and launch a fund, and why they should do that versus continue doing one-off syndications?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's all about like deal velocity. You're going to reach a point where if you've got really, really strong deal flow and you find yourself needing to close on, let's just say five, right? Five plus transactions a year. You're probably approaching the time where introducing a fund of some kind makes sense. Now, your first step, and this is, once again, I think it's, people tend to be a bit binary, right? Black and white on things. I'm going to switch from, I don't syndicate now, I'm just fund, right? Like, well, there's sort of an interim step that can exist, right? Where you introduce, hey, you might continue to syndicate. You've got this velocity. You're doing four deals, five deals, six deals a year, you know, plus or whatever, where you can tilt up, you know, a pooled fund that might be like your a co-investment fund, like a GP co-investment fund, where you let some investors come in, the GP co-invest vehicle takes down 10% of the equity required for each syndicated deal, right? And that might be a closed-ended fund that, you know, is sort of has a two-year investment period or something, but the investors then get kind of a better deal than they would probably, you know, going into each deal by themselves. You know, so you're kind of getting them on your side of it. That's a good way to kind of like make that transition from syndicating one at a time into the fund world, because then when you go to launch like an actual LP fund that's going to attempt to take down all the equity in all of your deals, you've at least, they can't say that this is your first fund. You know what I mean? And even if that's just, it just ends up being the co-investment fund, the GP co-investment fund is 20 LPs or whatever. It's kind of, you know, the best relationships you forged, you kind of get them on your side of the table, give up a little bit of the promote to them. It's a good thing to sort of do. And then it gets you, it's kind of training wheels for a fund.
So I've seen some companies out there that they administer and put together things that some people refer to as deal by deal segregated funds. I've heard lawyers refer to these as series LLCs. So I'm curious about this, man. If you have LPs, and from the sponsor perspective, if you want to give them the opportunity to get in multiple deals, but see them before they get into the deal, so it's not completely blind, is there a structure that you recommend? Is there stuff like that you put together? Tell us about what are the different structures of funds that you can potentially put together. Does that even make sense?
No, it does make sense, you know, and it's just, once again, it's like every situation's a bit different. So trying to find, you know, not just trying to create a crazy structure just for the sake of doing it, but like having it actually solve a problem that you're having. Like, there's this, you know, newer company called Avestor that has these customizable funds. You know, I think that's probably, you know, the closest thing that allows you to do something like that, Ruben, right? Like, you know, the ability to have a fund with one set of docs that allows you to sort of, you know, gives investors the ability to kind of pick and choose, you know, how much exposure they want to any given deal that the fund is in. and having, you know, direct exposure in the economics from that deal, you know, specifically flow to them. You know, I think that's a pretty neat solution for a lot of those sorts of deals. But I think, you know, when it comes to like series LLCs and as an example, I mean, it's really just becomes more of a way to save on having to, you know, keep paying the Delaware filing fees and things like that. It's as administrative as anything. And that would be a way where a serial syndicator could, you know, have different partners in each series LLC, but not having to, you know, keep tilting up a net new LLC every time that they need one. So once again, it's like finding a situation where someone's actually their strategy, you know, requires that. It's few and far between, you know. And then the other thing you're talking about is just the ability to kind of recapitalize other deals. I mean, it's tough to allow people to give them a peek in the fund world at deals if you don't control them. But once again, you see sort of like, you see how like everything that I kind of bring up is like driven by the types of assets, right? The assets and how you're coming into them dictates really how you should structure any of this stuff.
Yeah, one thing that I think you've always had a lot of insight as to where you think things are going. You talk about asset classes. If we were to take over the last 10 years, really in almost any real estate class, and we were kind of just to take it, you know, for real, so let's just say for inflation adjusted returns, you know, you'd have multifamily in that 9-10%. You'd have, you know, maybe you'd have office a little less, 7%. But if you take that average, there would probably be one or two quarters that were down, very few, the average, right, over that 10-year.
Yeah.
3-year, you'd have certainly a huge peak and a really low bottom. But you talk a lot about asset classes. I know you work in short-term rentals, industrial, you've had an experience in multifamily. Just give us kind of a state of affairs, your thoughts on where we are going for the next year or two, you know, interest rates, asset classes, new trends, kind of where do you see things happening over the next, let's say 12 to 24 months?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, so obviously I'm super bullish on industrial. I think I'm still pretty bullish on mobile home parks. I think that if they cool down a bit, I think that that'll still be an interesting strategy. Self-storage, you know, I think the build to rent stuff that you guys do is interesting. You know, obviously it has its own development risk and, you know, but once again, like as long as you get enough juice out in the deal, then I think it makes sense because that's a trend, right? People are kind of becoming a nation of renters. With that said, that's why I hate to kind of paint it that way, because I think there's certain guys that can find good deals in any market. I just believe that. I believe that real estate is a local business. You know, it's location, location, location. And I think it's driven by people who know their territory. So I'm a huge believer in that, that you'll be able to find success if you just put a fence around something, whether it's super narrow just on the strategy type, like we're doing with Class B Industrial. I mean, we're investing across the US heartland. But it's just, it's Class B industrial, right? So like we narrow the focus. So now we know what we're looking for so that when something meets the criteria or fits the buy box, we're going to create the asset acquisition strategy in a way where we're going to make sure we're one of the first people to know if something comes available in our markets with our asset type. So all that to say, like you can make money in any market up or down in any given asset class. Yeah. I mean, I think the things that are just going to continue to be maybe a little easier to do, like to pull off. And even if you're not, I would say like you could do hungover or something, you know, I think self-storage is still a good, you know, asset class and probably easier to make money in that. And, you know, I think, you know, like things like industrial, things that'll be harder, obviously office, but there might be opportunity there, right? To reposition those assets to multifamily or, you know, things like that. It's just, I think the important lesson is just to know that, especially if you're looking to be an allocator and not necessarily an operator or deal sponsor, it's just trying to find people who are using language like this, where they're very, very specific and it feels very niche-y, you know, like it's, they kind of know what they are. And then you can do the assessment on those given markets, that given stuff to see what your comfort level is. If you want to be an operator, that's my suggestion. Is just go as narrow as you can and dominate, you know, don't think in even metropolitan areas, think in like sub markets, like how can I just dominate neighborhoods, you know, things like that.
Capital raising in a fund or capital raising in general, creating some strategies. What have you learned over the years about raising money and what would you advise or yeah. give some input to the audience that's listening in about how to raise capital within a fund?
Yeah, I think the number one thing that all of the clients I've ever had, we administered a bunch of these funds too, right? So I was the fund administrator behind it. So I advise and consult on it and then get to see sort of, were they able to launch it, you know, get it off the ground and how much traction did they get? But I think every single client that had runaway success, the number one thing they all did was they spent a lot of time educating investors. It's sort of like opening the kimono, being as transparent as they can as it pertains to how we do what we do, the secret sauce to what we do. Here's the things to keep in mind, just educating. That's what we did, right? Like when we started doing what it amounted to an open-ended fund to funds or whatever, you know, what do? We trained investors on how to underwrite and conduct due diligence on other funds, right? Because we want them to feel comfortable. And if I'm the guy who taught them how to do it, you know, they want to go play golf. They don't necessarily want to do all the crap I just told them that's necessary to do it right. They're gonna be like, let me just give you my money. Having an educational platform and finding a way to amplify that message through means like podcasts and YouTube and social media and all that kind of stuff, just engaging the audience. That's a lot. We did a bunch of live events. You know, these are just tactics. But once again, it's like, how do we create engagement amongst the people that are already attracted to us that know, like, and trust us? How do we multiply those relationships so that we get that guy's friend, you know, as a reference, and then they get that guy's friend's friend, right? And on and on and on. That's the number one thing.
Were you a stage presenter yourself, or was it your companies that you were with?
I mean, yeah. I mean, I usually presented things like you've heard me talk about. So I'd be the guy to get on stage and talk about reporting and, you know, all this kind of stuff, fund structuring. I mean, did this very sort of thing. I never pitched any of our funds. I mean, subsequently, I now pitch, you know, my own funds. But yeah, I mean, I think, yeah, having stage presence, that's the other thing when people do get live. A good buddy of mine, Steven Seal, he spent a ton of time on his presentation. He had his 15-minute pitch was just, it was moving. Right. Like, I mean, it was choreographed. I mean, he, you know, and he ended up raising like $60-70 million into his fund because he leaned into his strategy with full conviction and kind of had the stage presence to deliver that message and that story and that pitch, right? Made it easy for people.
Lance, this has been really educational. Any parting words of wisdom for the aspiring or scaling fund manager as they're trying to navigate this world and figure out, where can I get information on launching a fund?
I think I always say, like, I spend more time talking people out of wanting to start a fund than trying to talk them into doing it. So, you know, I think some of the things that you said, Ruben, it's back up, understand what your actual objectives are, you know, where you want to be in 5 years or whatever, and realize this is a team sport, and align yourself with people that you enjoy being around that are competent and that you can bring value to the equation. But it's always about adding value, and you need to spend more time worried about those things than you do about how should I learn more about a fund? Because you could know everything in the world about funds and it wouldn't help you raise a red cent of money. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's my advice, man. It's just like, be relational, be helpful, add value, be a learner, align yourself with others, bootstrap, basically. I mean, that's what it's all about.
How does the audience get a hold of you, Lance?
You can find me on LinkedIn. So, you know, Lance Peterson, Pederson. You know, I pretty much connect with anyone who connects with me. I probably shouldn't, but I do. It's probably the fastest way. You can just message me there.
Awesome, Lance. Really appreciate your time. This has been incredibly informative. Thank you so much. We'll see you on the next one.
Legacy Acquisitions.